The Tom Woods Show, episode 2343.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As the academic year winds down, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do in the fall. And of course, I highly recommend the self-taught K through 12 Ron Paul curriculum. Not only will your kids get the real story about everything, but they'll also learn the kinds of practical things that they won't learn in the traditional school. For instance, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage money, and how to run your own home business. And of course, when they reach the high school grades, they will be learning Western civilization and U.S. government from old Tom Woods here. But here's the most important thing. If you're going to join, make sure you join through my link, because only through my link do you get $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. It is long overdue having our old friend David Stockman back on the show. You remember the great David Stockman, former U.S. Congressman, director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan, then spent some time doing honest work in the private sector. And here he is now running DavidStockmansContraCorner.com, where you get real analysis of what's actually going on in the world. Very, very much worth consulting. I'm going to have it linked on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2343. Of his books, the one that for me is the most indispensable is The Great Deformation, which basically gives us a revisionist economic history of the 20th century in the United States. But the most valuable part of it for me is the analysis of the bailouts in 2008 because of all the dire warnings we got if they weren't carried out. David's having none of that and throws cold water on all of it. And he's here to throw cold water on some other things with us this morning. So, David, welcome.
I'm glad to be with you again. And yes, there's a lot of cold water that I think needs to be thrown. And since you mentioned my days in the Reagan administration, it might be worthy to note that in the first month that we were in office, January 1981, we were struggling with the problem that the debt ceiling was going to go over $1 trillion. And we were all mortified that we were going to be, as a nation, $1 trillion in debt. Here they are, arm wrestling over $32 trillion, 32 times more. And after all the arm wrestling, they did nothing. I mean, this doesn't even scratch the surface. It is really almost a joke. It's a fiscal scam, and the Republicans really ought to be ashamed of themselves for essentially capitulating at the last minute when they had some real leverage. What I mean by that, and I think it's an important topic of discussion, is there is no such thing as an interest payment default. If we got to the point that they said we were going to be at on June 5th, in which the incoming cash wasn't sufficient to pay the outgoing bills, the Secretary of the Treasury and President have full authority to allocate the revenue that is coming in to the highest priority items. And of course, that would be debt service. Now, put this in perspective, we're getting in today about $450 billion a month of revenue, even with the economy kind of bumping along where it is. The interest payment per month on average is about $61 billion or 13%. So they can easily, you know, allocate or prioritize the incoming revenue to interest. No problem. There would never be a default. The bondholders would get their interest payments. Anything that was maturing can be rolled over. There would never be such a thing as a default. And beyond that, some of the big constituencies that could generate some mayhem could be paid as well. Social Security monthly averages $128 billion. Well, there's $450 billion coming in. You could handle that. You could handle the interest. You could spend $50 billion of that incoming revenue on military pay and O&M. So that means that the planes would fly, the ships would sail, the tanks would roll, the soldiers would be paid. Our national defense would not be let down or jeopardized in any way. I won't go through all the numbers, but my point is the Secretary of the Treasury can prioritize to things like defense or Social Security, but especially pay the interest. There's never a default. Why is this important? It's because the debt ceiling is the only tool of fiscal management left. They don't pass budget resolutions anymore or the reconciliation bill that forces changes in spending or revenue. Back in the day when I was there, we considered it kind of almost a sacred duty. If you're going to run the United States of America budget, you've got to have an annual budget and a resolution and agreement from Congress and the White House as to what the content would be. They don't even bother to pass them anymore. Back in the day when I started working on Capitol Hill in the 70s, the big cycle was 12 annual appropriations bills, one for health and human services, another for the interior, another for agriculture and so forth. They don't even bother to pass appropriations bills anymore that cover the 25% of the budget that is so-called discretionary spending or not automatic. They just wait for a continuing resolution the first day of the new fiscal year, have a couple of those, and end up with this massive omnibus appropriation halfway into the fiscal year, a 3,000-page bill that nobody has read, and it's just dripping with pork. So the reason I go through this is that if you don't have a budget resolution because they just skip their fundamental duty, and you don't pass appropriations bills, the only way that you can get any kind of control or leverage over this monster, I call it the fiscal doomsday machine, is when the debt ceiling expires and you force the Treasury to allocate the available revenue. That would put a huge squeeze on everybody out there that's on the public teat, so to speak, the highway contractors, the military contractors, the state and local governments, the students getting their monthly grants and so forth. And that would really bring some pressure to bear on the people who, which in this case would be that slim House majority, who want some kind of serious change. But instead of recognizing that, Tom, the thing that needed to happen was that the Treasury needed to be forced into allocation, into prioritization next week. And if that would have happened, then the whole myth of debt default, of the credit of the United States being ruined, that whole myth would be destroyed, and the underlying fiscal equation would be on a totally new footing going forward. But they blew it. They blinked. And once you blink on this proposition that we're going to default on the interest payment, then the powers that be, the status quo, has got all the leverage. And so they came up with this joke that basically saves less than 1/3 of 1% of spending over the next 10 years. If you look at what's really there and not all the budget tricks that they've employed.
All right, I have a couple questions I want to run by. First is, can you at least understand why, although over the years I followed news like this very closely, I've just lost my appetite for it because I know the outcome already. I already know what's going to happen. The Republicans are going to cave, nothing's going to change, and then we have this charade the following year. Every single year it's the same thing. And then every single year we get, let's say, a couple of the decent U.S. senators saying, ah, the conservatives have been sold out again. Why are we acting like we're surprised about this? So I've come to the conclusion that I used to be naive enough to think, well, at some point we're going to get serious. We're going to realize the spending's out of control and we're going to have some priorities. I've just concluded that obviously it's going to come to grief. So now I've transferred my interest to other topics.
Well, you know, I can't take issue with that because it has happened over and over and over and over again. And yet, it's always treated by the mainstream media and even some of the dissenting press a little bit, Fox News, for instance, as some kind of serious moment where big decisions are being made. And what I've been trying to say, and I agree with you, is no decision has been made. It's just another kick the can, another opportunity to drift and stumble forward and build up the debt until we reach what someday will be a breaking point. I don't know when that comes. But to answer your question, that's how we got in my lifetime from $1 trillion. Actually, when I went to Capitol Hill in 1970, I worked on the Hill for 10 years. I was a congressman in the second half of the 1970s. But the federal debt was $300 billion. Okay, now it's $30 trillion. That happened in my lifetime. Okay, and it was $1 trillion when Reagan said he's going to try to stop the machine from expanding. We made a little progress, but not much. Yet here we are today. It's $32 trillion. It's more than that. When they replenish the Treasury's coffers, which are now empty, the public debt will go over $32 trillion. And if you look at the CBO forecast in which all of this budgetary scorekeeping is based that we've been hearing about in the last few days, the public debt is going to be $55 trillion at the end of the 10-year window that we're in today. In other words, by the early 2030s will be at $55 trillion, which is, you know, as people know, roughly double what today's GDP is. So you're right, it's drifting towards the wall. The Republicans have totally abdicated their responsibility. The job of the Republican Party in American democracy is to say no, okay, is to be the defender of the taxpayer, to be the keeper of fiscal rectitude, to be the advocate for sound money, to be the defender of free markets. What are they doing? I don't know. They're trying to protect the borders or some damn thing, or support all of these forever wars and liberate Ukraine and the rest of the nonsense that's going on. But when it comes to their main job about the integrity of money, the integrity of our financial affairs, they're nowhere to be seen. They're engaging in the kind of charades that McCarthy led during the last couple of weeks.
Well, let me ask you this. I know there are people listening who would love to hear some specifics about if instead of Kevin McCarthy up against Biden and his people, it had been David Stockman, what particular strategy would you have followed and what demands would you have made?
Okay, that's a great question. I would have had, first of all, a demand, since they were saying the so-called X date is June 5th, give me a schedule, and they know it, give me a schedule of the payments that are scheduled by day for the first several weeks during June. Let's see what those are. Let's see what date the interest payments are due, and so we know what the facts are. And then the second thing I would have said is that if you want to continue to negotiate in good faith some real changes in the what they'd call the fiscal trajectory, then give us a pledge that when push comes to shove, the debt service payments on that schedule will be made and that others will be deferred if necessary in order to make those debt service payments. And once that was agreed to, then the whole idea of debt default is off the table. The whole idea that Biden is sitting there taking a nap with a gun to the head of Congress would have been removed. There would have been no risk of default. There would have been a risk that certain interest groups, certain beneficiaries, certain state and local governments would not, say, get their Medicaid reimbursement on June 10th and might have to wait till June 20th. But all of that would have changed the whole leverage dynamic of the process. And that's what they should have said. They should have said, we reject the debt default scenario. And let's go back, if you don't want to accept the Republican view of this, let's go back to 2011 when we had the last big showdown, as a lot of people remember, and consult the dean of liberal constitutional scholars in the United States at that time and still, Lawrence Tribe, the professor of law at Harvard Law School, and see what he said the Obama administration should do if the debt ceiling isn't raised, and that was July of 2011. He said the Treasury has to allocate available revenue to what priorities it deems necessary to establish. In other words, this isn't a right-wing view. This isn't some kind of Federalist Society paper on constitutional law. This is what the liberals have always said. Of course, you haven't heard anything about this in the last couple of weeks because, you know, they wanted to use the old blackmail of debt default. And I think what I would have done is to say, we're going to stick with Lawrence Tribe. We're going to force you to pay the interest, but to defer, shove in the drawer, so to speak, some other due bills for a few days so that we have time to negotiate and so that the political equation in this country is a little bit more balanced towards fiscal responsibility and the taxpayers and less to all of these groups that get funded month after month after month on the public tee. Then I would have said, now that we've understand each other, let's look at the budget. And of course, there's a lot that has to be changed here, but I would say we've got four big elements in the spending outlook, which is not mine, it's CBO's. The outlook is we're dealing with $80 trillion of spending built into current law, current policy over the next decade. And there are four big elements, $49 trillion of that $80 trillion is entitlements and mandatories, and the biggest piece of that is Social Security at $18 trillion, Medicare at $12 or $13 trillion, etc. Piece number one, we got to have major entitlement reform. Piece number two, $10 trillion of that is defense. We can't be the policeman of the world with 800 bases. Forever wars everywhere and interventions. This has all got to stop. The empire has to be dismantled. We need to recycle defense to homeland security, homeland defense. And we could do that for less than half of the $900 billion a year that we're now spending. So second, we attack the $10 trillion for defense. Third, we look at the $10 trillion for domestic so-called discretionary programs, and you know, that goes all the way across the board from agriculture subsidies to zoological studies. There's huge amounts that can be retrenched or eliminated entirely there. And then finally, we've got $10 trillion for interest payments on the public debt, just sorry. And if we attack the first three, entitlements, defense, and non-defense discretionary, we'll automatically reduce some of that $10 trillion that otherwise is going to go out the door in the next decade for interest payments. So that's the approach that the Republican Party ought to take. But they are pretty pathetic when it comes to their job. Their job in American democracy is exactly what I've just described, and they're simply not doing it.
Well, here's the problem, as I'm sure you know. In everything you've just described, there are extremely powerful, well-organized interest groups at work that don't want to see $1 removed from what they are accustomed to getting. But then on the other hand, you think, well, okay, it's true we have these interest groups, but we do have the general interest of the American public, which is in keeping the fiscal house in order. The problem with that is that's not an organized interest group, and most Americans don't even understand what the consequences of having a fiscal house in disarray means for them. It doesn't seem to have any direct impact on them. And even if it would in some hypothetical future, that's no match for, you know, Northrop Grumman.
Right. Well, Tom, I'll tell you there, this then gets us to step two in this whole discussion, this whole analysis. And step two is, if you want to change that difficult equation that every interest group is noisy and squeaky and the general taxpayer is out there trying to make a living and take care of a family, make ends meet, and that's an inherently difficult equation, what you need to do is lay out the proposition that the interest groups don't have to totally dominate the process if you change the playing field, let's say. And the only way you can change the playing field is one of two directions. One is through reform of the electoral process, so we don't have incumbents who get reelected year after year, election after election, and then settle down with all the interest groups in Washington and then become their bag carriers for the system. That's number one. Or number two, we go to town and it would be a huge uphill struggle for a constitutional amendment that basically requires a balanced budget. I see no other way to level the playing field, but those sound like almost impossible propositions. So the third thing we need to do is pin the tail on the real donkey here, which is the Federal Reserve. And what I mean by that is if the Fed did not monetize trillions of the public debt year after year, and especially after 2020 when they went crazy with all these COVID relief and bailout and stimmy plans, which were all funded with debt, if the Fed would stop monetizing the public debt, then the Treasury borrowing these huge magnitudes, you know, it's going to be $2 trillion this year again, and next year and the year after, and as far as the eye can see, that process, if you funded all this debt in the bond pits rather than at the Fed's printing press, interest rates would be pushed sky high, private borrowers would be squeezed out, homeowners that wanted to refund their mortgage or get a new mortgage could be penalized very heavily, and there would be a countervailing message coming into Washington that you can't keep borrowing all this money because you're causing mayhem on Main Street. Now, this isn't a theory. This is what happened. This is what used to happen in the 60s and 70s. This is what we had to deal with all the time that I was in Congress and in the White House. The Fed was not yet monetizing the debt. Therefore, the big borrowing that occurred squeezed out, crowded out so-called private borrowers, drove interest rates much higher, created economic pain, which then ricocheted back into the political process and created at least a reasonable constituency on Capitol Hill, actually in both parties, for some semblance of fiscal restraint. But after Greenspan, after 1987, it was all over except the shouting, because once they went into the monetization business, once they decided they were going to pin interest rates at totally sub-economic levels relative to what the private market would produce, then all of this countervailing pressure that came from crowding out and higher interest rates disappeared, dissipated, and Congress went its merry way, running deficits year after year, bigger and bigger, doing things that we mentioned a moment ago, setting aside the whole annual budget resolution process, not passing appropriations bills, having a debt ceiling crisis every couple of years, and then raising it again and again. All of that can go right back to 1987, Greenspan's arrival at the Fed, and the beginning of this terrible process of monetization by the central bank. In fact, if you pushed me hard, instead of the three things, electoral reform, changing the Fed in a constitutional amendment, I would go for changing the Fed in a heartbeat. Because at the end of the day, if you have a central bank that could print the money, the politicians will never stop spending and borrowing. It's that basic. It's that fundamental.
Hey, folks, some very quick Father's Day advice from our friends at Omaha Steaks. Number one, do not wait until the last minute to get your father a nice gift. But secondly, get him something he's actually going to enjoy and something he's definitely not expecting. Some juicy steaks and other goodies from Omaha Steaks. Head over to omahasteaks.com. Use promo code WOODS at checkout and get $30 off your qualifying order. Packages for dad can include bacon-wrapped filet mignons or other gourmet grillables like their boneless chicken breasts, juicy burgers, jumbo franks, and by the way, a hot dog is not a sandwich, but don't get me started. Many more favorites available too. Plus, save room for dessert. Most gift packages come with four delicious caramel apple tartlets. The Woods family has been ordering Omaha steaks for at least a dozen years. It's super convenient, great value, and excellent quality. Plus, he'll be the envy of all the other dads. Well, whether he's your father, father-in-law, or father figure, get him something he really wants because dads want steak. Order today and get $30 off with promo code WOODS. That's promo code WOODS at omahasteaks.com. Minimum order may be required. See site for details. I want to give you a chance to say a quick word about a book you released last year. I'm telling you, folks, David Stockman's ContraCorner.com. When you read his pieces and how detailed and thorough they are, you can understand how he's able to churn out books so fast because he has so much material. Yeah. But you released a book called The Great Money Bubble, Protect Yourself from the Coming Inflation Storm, which is here. Now, they're saying that with each passing month, the inflation, the price inflation is dying down. Maybe you can comment on that. Maybe it's a temporary thing and it was hard, but it's going away. Maybe you can comment on that. But give us a sense of the general thesis of that book, and I'll link to it on the show notes page.
That's a great timely question because it links right to the whole Fed discussion we've been having. In other words, I said inflation is coming when the book was printed. That was last summer. It was getting up a pretty good head of steam. It's obviously here now. But my point was the inflation was not just in the price of food or the price of gasoline or the CPI. It was a broad-based distortion of the economy due to all of this money printing by the Fed and the enormous amount of fiat credit and liquidity that was being pumped into the system. And you started with asset inflation. I mean, we've had a massive asset inflation, stock prices, bond prices, real estate prices, and so forth for the last several decades, but particularly in the last few years. It eventually worked its way into the world economy because all the other central banks were doing the same money printing shtick as the Fed. And eventually, a hiccup came in the course of world economics. That is, you know, we had the COVID, we had the supply chain breakdowns and dislocations, and all of this built up inflationary pressure that was in the system for years and years came rushing even into the goods and services arena. And suddenly the Fed woke up with not 2% or 4% or 6% inflation, but an inflation rate that was pushing 10%. For a while, they said, well, this is transitory. It'll all go away on its own. It didn't. And now they've had to wake up to the fundamental thing that has been wrong for at least a decade now, and that is their target interest rate, which you know is the federal funds rate, has been set below the inflation rate 90% of the time since late 2007. So when you have the money market rate, which is like the benchmark rate for all the short-term money borrowing and deposits, money markets, and so forth in the financial system, below the inflation rate, you are asking for a hellacious financial mess. And that's what we now have. So it's going to take a long time to correct this. The Fed has to get interest rates back up above the inflation rate and keep them there. It has to shrink its hideously bloated balance sheet. And again, I think some numbers are useful. At the time of even the so-called financial crisis of 2008, 2009, the Fed's balance sheet before the big bailout started when Lehman went into Chapter 11, September 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was $900 billion. And it had taken like 75 years to get there from when the Fed had opened for business. And it went from less than $1 trillion to $9 trillion in the last decade or a little more. And that's what's totally distorted the whole system. So my book goes through all of the consequences, all of the impacts of that massive balance sheet expansion at the Fed, because the balance sheet is just a measure of how much money they print. Because on the other side, the assets they own are liabilities, and liabilities are either reserves at the Fed or currency, hand-to-hand currency. But in any event, that's the heart of the matter. The rest of the central banks of the world followed suit. People probably don't recognize that the Fed wasn't a lone ranger by any means. So if you go back to 2002, the balance sheets of all the central banks of the world were about $3 trillion. They're now $45 trillion. So we've had a 15x increase in central bank credit in the global economy during the last two decades. So you have to get to those fundamentals. A lot of that is laid out in the book. And much of it then becomes relevant day to day as we bump and grind from one crisis to another, which is really what I try to keep up with in Contra Corner on a daily basis.
Well, again, I cannot urge reading Contra Corner strongly enough. And so I will say, David, it is a slightly long URL, davidstockmanscontracorner.com, but it is worth every keystroke, my friend. So check that out, and David's book as well at tomwoods.com/2343. And David, thanks so much for your time and for sticking with this.
Okay, well, great to be with you. And the saga continues, and we'll discuss the next phase as it unfolds in the future.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.